Welcome to Deep Dive from the Japan Times. I'm Sean McKenna. You know, I've been seeing a lot of old friends from home recently, and they're among the hordes of tourists who've been taking advantage of the cheaper yen and post-pandemic wanderlust. And tourists have been everywhere in the news. Monthly visitors in March exceeded 3 million for the first time ever, a number that held strong in April. And not everyone has been behaving in a way the locals appreciate. So, starting in April, tourists were banned from private alleys in Kyoto's Gion district, giving the geisha a little respite from these budding paparazzi. And of course, a town in Yamanashi built a 2.5-meter-high, 20-meter-long mesh net to block the view of Mount Fuji at a prime photo spot that tourists were clogging up. Long lines, crowds of selfie sticks, tourist bans. For people coming here for the first time, as well as longer-term residents, there's this question. Has Japan become like Venice or Paris, an ossified Disneyland in which people are resigned to copy-paste an itinerary? In short, is it still possible to have an original travel experience in Japan? After 5 years of living in Japan, today's guest still thinks it's possible, but you've got to be willing to sweat a little. On this week's episode, I'm talking to culture writer Tu Hung Ha about her feature from April, Why is the Most Exciting Art in Japan So Hard to Get To? She reported on a unique movement of art in Japan that encourages sweaty, inconvenient travel, a movement that challenges assumptions of how people ought to consume art and culture. Hi, Tu. Welcome back to Deep Dive.
Happy to be here.
So today we're talking about what you've dubbed Japan's inconvenient art movement. You detailed this in an article for the Japan Times in April. And if I can just read a section of what you wrote. To complete one of the original pilgrimages of the contemporary art world, you must eschew Japan's august convenience completely. You must be willing to sweat, to arrive early to stand in a queue, to trawl PDFs on your phone, to wander abandoned villages looking for signage, to run and catch the ferry or bus, to beg forgiveness of a white-gloved attendant for any number of rule violations. Japan, in my experience, I'd describe it as a place of great convenience. So what are you finding inconvenient? What exactly is inconvenient art?
Japan has this unique thing where a lot of public money goes into putting really, really great art in places that are really, really hard to get to.
So we're not talking like getting to Ueno by the Yamanote Line during rush hour, right?
No.
It's more like the giant polka-dotted pumpkin out west?
Exactly. So I think listeners would probably recognize Yayoi Kusama's Yellow Pumpkin in Naoshima, which is this big yellow sculpture with black spots, and in the background is this blue sea.
Yeah, I've never been.
Sean, you've lived in Japan for 23 years and you've never been to Naoshima.
Now, it's on my to-do list for this year. Okay, back off.
It's time. Yeah, I mean, it is very far. And I think that is part of the appeal for me. These inconvenient art sites and events and works are usually placed far from any major city, far from any Shinkansen station. You need a lot of patience. You need a lot of logistics. It's definitely not cheap. It's definitely time-consuming.
Well, let's talk about that distance for a minute. So I think from my house, I think I'd need to catch a train to either an airport or a Shinkansen station, fly to like what, Osaka or Okayama?
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd need to catch a ferry, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I want a vacation. I don't want around Japan in 80 days. But, you know, Deep Dive producer Dave Cortez, didn't you visit Naoshima?
Yeah, I did a few years ago. I really enjoyed the art, but it was August in 2021, and in my nearly 10 years in Japan, I have never experienced such a hot day. I was actually kind of baffled, like, really? Naoshima is the hottest place on the planet right now? But yeah, I did get a selfie with the pumpkin.
And then that pumpkin blew away, famously.
Yeah, I was actually there the day before that happened, so this really hot day with not a cloud in the sky, but then the next day this huge typhoon rolls in and washes the pumpkin away, and I see it on the news just floating.
Yeah, imagine going all that way to Naoshima and then there's no pumpkin. I think that's part of the risk of these, like, inconvenient art spots. They take a lot of logistics, and then once you're there, it's just like, yeah, weather.
Yeah, in your article, though, you make this seem like a feature. So it's kind of like the idea that, not to sound corny, but like the cherry blossoms, right? These are objects of beauty that are only here for a limited time. Is it part of the appeal that the artworks could disappear at any minute?
I mean, the inconvenience is definitely by design. I think the artists and the organizers know that they're taking a risk. they're putting these public works just out there in the elements. But I don't know if they're like psyched about the fragility. Like, it's very romantic to think of it that way. But I think, you know, these are partly publicly funded works and projects, and I can see how that can become hard to justify.
So you might be thinking of Okunoto, right?
Right. So last fall, I went to Okunoto Triennale, which is very inconvenient. It's at the tip of the Noto Peninsula in Ishikawa Prefecture. There's only two flights a day from Tokyo, and then you've got to drive or you're like totally stranded. And on January 1st of this year, it was hit by a pretty bad earthquake.
Yeah. So you're referring to the earthquake that hit New Year's Day. It was a magnitude 7.6. And as of last month, there were 245 people who had died and maybe three still missing, but thousands displaced from their homes and without permanent housing.
Yeah, that's right. And about half of the works from that festival sustained damage.
That actually reminds me of something in your story, and it had to do with the Salt Tower. Do you want to tell that story?
Sure, yeah. So A Path of Memories, which is a work by Motoi Yamamoto, it's this big salt tower structure. It's actually inside, and as many of these works are, it's in an abandoned school.
Mm.
And it's in this bright blue room, and the salt is this like pure white Ishikawa salt. It looks like a crumbling brick wall, and it's on the bottom, the salt is like meticulously combed like a Zen garden.
Mm.
Took volunteers 50 days over 5 months to complete, and had already survived a big earthquake in May 2023. And when I was there in the fall of 2023, I saw a toddler like almost end that artwork. She was barreling right for it. She was about to just like jump right in there, and she was screaming, "I want to touch it!" But then one of her adults caught her in time.
But the salt tower didn't survive the January quake.
No, it survived the toddler, but it did not survive the earthquake, and it's been completely toppled. But I did see on social media that Yamamoto said that maybe he can restore the tower.
So if I were to make a checklist of what constitutes inconvenient art, I could probably add inaccessibility and maybe a kind of fragility and that public funding aspect, at least in terms of what Japan's doing.
Yeah, I think so.
So what sparked your interest in this style of displaying art?
The first time I came to Japan was actually a decade ago next week. Mm. I went to Naoshima on that trip, and I went to Teshima, which is another inconvenient art spot. It's the neighboring island to Naoshima. And back then, I mean, I wasn't living in Japan, but I really, like, nobody I knew had heard of these places, like maybe one or two people.
Did you know much about Japan at the time?
I didn't. It was my first time. It was just a, you know, trip with my parents. I was in my 20s. I wasn't really doing what I wanted in my career. I actually got unexpectedly dumped the night before I left for my trip. I was very frayed on this trip. Not a lot of sleep and a lot of emotions. But I think I didn't realize at the time, but I think Teshima really profoundly affected my life and like kind of in a very, very indirect way set me on a trajectory that like kind of oriented me for maybe where I'm sitting right now.
Hmm.
It also kind of more concretely got me interested in pursuing these kind of remote art destination type of places. So I think I've probably since then, I've traveled some like 10,000 miles in the US and in Japan to see these kinds of, you know, hard to access works. I've missed many boats. I've gotten speeding tickets. I got caught in this like really intense apocalyptic lightning storm. I've sweat a lot. I've lost a lot of money because of like logistical mistakes.
I think we've all been there actually. Except I don't have anything to show for it. I haven't even been to Naoshima. But I guess for you, I mean, like that initial pilgrimage, it seems to have had some kind of impact.
Yeah, I think it definitely taught me a different way of traveling.
So we've been talking about the inconvenient pilgrimage to the far reaches of Japan to see this kind of art. Is this kind of experience unique to Japan? Like, do other countries have art that's hard to get to?
Yeah, for sure they do. I think a prominent example is land art, which is a conceptual art movement from the 1960s and 70s in the U.S. Especially prominent example is Spiral Jetty by Robert Smithson. These are works that are built directly into the earth and are often in like hard to reach places because that's where there's space to build them.
Mm.
But it wasn't always the point to actually go and see them. So part of the concept would be to record the works being made and then being eroded in photos and video. And those would be like shown in a gallery in New York, for example. But, you know, with these, the point is going is definitely part of it. In Japan, I think these inconvenient art places are, you know, to use a very journalistic term, more of a thing. They're more mainstream. You see kids at them. And then there's this element of, you know, integration with the public citizenry.
Well, tell us a little bit more about how this thing came about. Like, where did it all begin?
So it really did start in Naoshima, actually. So now Naoshima has this robust tourism industry, but from the early 1900s, it was actually a place for a large-scale copper refinery, and that was the dominant industry there. That was on the island's north side. In 1955, during Japan's post-war baby boom, the population of the island peaked at 7,500. That's more than double what it is today. And by the 1960s, half of the working population of Naoshima was in manufacturing. But, you know, pollution became like a pretty big problem, and agriculture was also a big problem here. Agriculture is, I think, still difficult to sustain on the north side of the island. Mm. The groundwater has this really intense sulfuric smell.
Wow. Like, Naoshima sounds like it was in rough shape.
Yeah. And there was a mayor who played like an outsized importance in Naoshima's history. Chikatsugu Miyake really wanted to change the image of Naoshima. And he served from 1959 to 1995.
Wow, what a term.
He was also the priest of the main shrine.
Renaissance man.
So in 1985, he met Tetsuhiko Fukutake, who was the founder of Fukutake Publishing, which today is the billion-dollar corporation Benesse Holdings. Mm. They met on the south side of the island, so like not the factory side, and they talked about building a cultural center for kids. After Fukutake died unexpectedly, his son Soichiro came back to Okayama to take over the business. And then in 1988, Soichiro met Taro Ando.
Right. So Taro Ando is a celebrated Pritzker Prize-winning Japanese architect. And in Tokyo, you might know his work. He did the revamped Shibuya Station, at least the subway part of it. Omotesando Hills, but he's designed a lot of museums across the country, right? Like, including Tokyo Art Museum.
Right, that Taro Ando. At that time, he was only 47. He was still 7 years away from winning the Pritzker. And these two guys got together. They weren't even sure they were going to work together. They met in izakaya, and then, yeah, kind of the rest is history. Now Naoshima is covered in what's very recognizable Taro Ando architecture.
You know, some of the most productive conversations happen at Japanese izakaya.
You don't have to tell me twice. So just backing up a little bit, they completed this arts camp in 1989, Naoshima International Camp, and Fukutake was getting more interested in art. In 1988, he went to this big Monet show in Boston. And he saw a water lilies painting 2 by 6 meters. And he writes in his book, Naoshima Setouchi Aato no Rakuen, or Naoshima Setouchi Art Paradise. He said that the painting called to him. It said, buy me, keep me near you. And so, you know, he did what any other billionaire to be would do. He bought the Monet.
Of course.
And in 2004, he opened Chichu Art Museum, which is an underground building also designed by Ando. It has just a few permanent works, which includes the water lilies, and installations by American artists James Turrell and Walter DeMaria. And I think that museum, the Chichu Museum, is really what set Naoshima on its course for now. Tourism to Naoshima had been kind of steady. And then after the opening of the museum, numbers jumped. They nearly doubled in the Chichu's first year, and then they doubled again by 2007.
So can we say that these three men, Chikatsugu Miyake, Soichiro Fukutake, and Taro Ando, were they kind of like the fathers of inconvenient art?
So there's actually one more key player who wasn't like there yet.
Okay.
His name is From Kitagawa.
Right. Okay. Tell us more about what he did.
So Kitagawa is really different from these other guys. His name, From Furamu, is very unusual. You know, that's his actual name. His father gave it to him. It's Norwegian for progress. And his father was an expelled member of the Communist Party. Kitagawa was pretty left. Like, he organized this traveling art exhibition that was an anti-apartheid-themed event that went all around Japan in the 1980s. In 2000, he organized the first Echigo Tsumari Art Triennale, which was an art festival with site-specific works by pretty big names. Turrell, like I said, Marina Abramović. People could actually stay overnight in these artworks. I stayed in one and came on this podcast to talk about it, where I had to sleep in a coffin. The festival was designed really as a revitalization project. So it has a couple of goals. One is to instill pride in the local citizens, to make them, you know, proud again of where they live, to bring in outside tourism, obviously, to boost the local economy. And to some extent, I think they're hoping that young people will want to relocate to these rapidly depopulating regions.
How was the reaction from the art world? Did the art world really like it?
No. It was not a hit. I mean, I think the first one, barely anyone came. Maybe like once a day, someone would show up to see the work. There were a lot of complaints about humidity, about signage.
So you went in 2022, and it kind of sounded like the same issues sort of still exist, right? Like, we spoke to you, as you mentioned, about the trip here on the podcast. Actually, that was almost a year ago.
Yeah, it was hot, man. And even by then, it was its eighth edition, and it was super, super hard to navigate. Mm-hmm. Like, Niigata has these intensely humid summers. In the winter, it can get up to 9 meters of snow. Mm. The artworks are, like, half in the wild. Like, we had paper maps. We were using their app. We had our own GPS, and it was still really hard to navigate. You just kind of end up, like, driving through like some overgrown brush and just being like, yeah, is that art? Like, I can't tell. Like, I think I see art. And then, yeah, and then you stop the car and like look for a sign to like check if it's art or not. We're used to seeing art in a very different way. Obviously, like, art isn't usually hardy. It needs like air conditioning and like to conservation. And so, you know, that's what we're used to seeing in an art museum or in a gallery. But that was actually the point. Like, Kitagawa didn't want this typical art experience. He saw it, as he writes in his book, Hiraku Bijutsu, or open art. He saw it, the charm of inefficient and sweaty art exhibitions.
Yeah, you must suffer for your art. But I don't know if I should suffer. But how do we connect Fram Kitagawa to this giant yellow polka dot pumpkin in Naoshima?
Eventually, Echigo Tsumari did win people over. It took, a couple editions to get going. And I think people started to appreciate, like, the remoteness and the stress, and they start to think of it maybe as a bit more like a pilgrimage. Mm. And it was successful enough that it started to kind of become Kitagawa's like signature model. And people, like local governments from around the country, were calling him up and being like, hey, can you come do it in our place? And in 2006, after the third Echigo Tsumari Triennale, Kitagawa got a call from none other than Soichiro Fukutake of Benesse. He said, come and work on a festival based in Naoshima.
So help us put this into context. Why is inconvenient art so special? Like, why are you two and all these Japanese people driving around in the heat looking for polka dot pumpkins?
So I like this quote from this book about classical Japanese travel literature by Meredith McKinney. It's called Travels with a Writing Brush. And it's about Heian Kyoto, which is like 800 to like 1200. Mm. You know, you think it's this really far thing in the past. But what she says is that an understandable distaste for travel was heavily reinforced by the firm conviction that the capital, which was Kyoto, was really the only place for a civilized person to be. The capital was the central site of culture, and the land beyond its borders quickly shaded off into the cultural equivalent of the wilds. And I think that could just as easily apply today to New York or Paris or London or Tokyo. Like, art concentrates in the cultural capitals because that's where people buy it. In Tokyo, the galleries are in Ginza, in Shibuya, Roppongi. There's a bunch of new art fairs that are in the cities. The aim of those is to bring all these gallerists together in this really, you know, densely crowded place so that collectors can have easy and efficient access to new works. And like, they don't even have to take a train, right? People really don't want to be inconvenienced when they're, like, shopping.
Yeah, this is more about shopping than art. I get that. Okay.
But even on the museum side, like, so not the commercial side, like, Japan really favors what are called blockbuster exhibitions. Large-scale shows of big-name crowd-pleasers often requires a bunch of paintings to be shipped in from Europe. They're not resilient. They need to be carefully lit, kept in climate-controlled conditions. They're heavily patrolled by staff, like, who, you know, control the photography and people's behavior. Mm. But, you know, the founders of Japan's inconvenient art movement, they really wanted to challenge the urban monopoly on art. They wanted something different. And in their success, you know, definitely I would call it mainstream success, they've radically changed the way that culture is consumed in contemporary Japan. There's actually good reason to think that this could be reflecting back on the market itself. So last year, according to a global markets report put out by Art Basel, there was a surge in interest among global art collectors in acquiring work from Japan, which isn't something that the industry has seen since post-war decades. This kind of like, you know, Japan is hip again, I guess.
Right.
And as a Roppongi gallerist like kind of speculated to me, he thinks that Naoshima could actually have a big part in this. So previously, collectors, when they came from abroad, they would just, you know, go to Tokyo, they would go to Kyoto, they would stop, you know, in the cities. But now they're going to be definitely stopping in Naoshima. It's kind of like an essential stop on any Japan art trip. And this gallerist says that he believes that the exposure that they have to these kind of more remote parts of Japan, their nature, history, culture, you know, could be actually fueling like a burgeoning interest among collectors to have like a closer relationship to Japan in general. And that could actually genuinely be moving the needle on the business of contemporary Japanese art.
You know, when I think of the art that's on display in Naoshima, I'm kind of thinking like, where does the art kind of stop and a landmark begin? Because I think that like pumpkin is even beyond art. It's kind of a landmark at this point.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's a really nice way of putting it. There are, you know, these artworks after over time, they're going to start to become, you know, kind of like permanent fixtures of these places. And I think that that's part of the goal. But there are, you know, there are pieces that rotate as well. And they bring in new works that are commissioned for the festivals and they'll take them down after, or some of them also get left.
Okay. So it's not kind of a thing where you visit Naoshima once and then you never go back there.
Yeah, I think definitely I've seen in the kind of lesser known islands, which I've also covered for the paper, there's like still so much to be explored.
Right.
And they change.
Huh. So you talk in your piece about how you think this could be something that only happens in Japan.
Well, right. I think that the public funding aspect of the projects is a big part of it. You know, these local governments are really, really, really invested. But also I think something I noticed that intrigued me was when I talked to some artists in Okunoto, you know, they had come from countries like India, I think Mexico, Colombia, Spain. They all said like the same thing, which is that they thought that maybe these public artworks and public art projects might only be possible in a place like Japan where the works will just like not be stolen or like vandalized and people will not like do a lot of graffiti on them. They all described like a kind of respect for the works and a non-touching aspect of it.
Right,
so like
okay.
Even kids wouldn't just like run up and start touching it. And it's not a bad thing if, you know, kids want to touch public art. That's like a normal reaction.
That one girl with the salt tower.
Exactly. Like that actually to me made perfect sense as a reaction from her perspective.
Yeah.
But I think that they can last quite a long time and in the way that the artist intended it because of this. It's almost like bringing the museum respect for the art outside and to these public artworks. Huh. But then at the same time, Japan is itself under constant risk of, you know, geological threats.
Right,
So I think that also adds this kind of like, as we discussed before, like a bit of this like special fragility or vulnerability that, you know, gives it this nice extra friction.
Hmm. So when thinking about this from a tourist perspective, is this kind of like just another argument for, you know, the journey is the destination kind of thing?
Or, rude.
You know, like, is it, you know, a unique travel experience that, you know, like maybe tourist 2.0 can kind of have?
So if you don't mind, I'm going to just bring in a little bit of theory here.
Oh, go ahead. It's deep dive.
But in literary criticism, so, you know, when we talk about books, there's something called reader response theory. And that emphasizes a very active ongoing participation between the reader and the work. So we typically think of in traditional reading as we as the reader read a text and we kind of extract something from it. But in this kind of theory, it's more of a give and take. It's more of a to and fro. And it, you know, both kind of reader and work kind of give to each other. And I'm kind of surprised, but I haven't seen as much corresponding theory in visual art, which I personally find surprising because I think that art in many ways is more subjective. And so what inconvenient art does, like because of all this like extra hair on your experience, it brings out an even richer and like more fruitful transaction between the viewer and the work. Mm. If it's okay for me to quote my own writing, my own piece. With all its stress and obstacles, its bad weather and tangents, its knots and missed chances, art pilgrimages generate millions more threads and crisscrossings of potential. And to me, that's really the art of inconvenience.
So even an uncultured goof like myself has heard of Naoshima and Echigo Tsumari. That's because I read the Japan Times. Are there any other inconvenient art spots around Japan?
Well, so yeah, if we just look at the Kitagawa project, Echigo Tsumari Art Triennale starts in July this year.
Okay.
He's also doing one in Nagano Prefecture in the fall. That's the Northern Alps Art Festival.
That sounds hard to get to.
Sounds very hard to get to and very beautiful. And then next year will be the Seto Uchi Triennale that runs all year. That's the one that's in Naoshima. And then Okunoto Triennale, which was last fall, as I said, it's still pending if there's going to be another one because of the earthquake.
Okay, so given the torment that you've gone through on your journeys, do you have any tips for other inconvenient art lovers out there?
Bring deodorant.
Okay, yep, that's a good one. Yeah.
GPS is very helpful. Like, you know, I think you're going to need data if you're not a local resident. You better get some data.
Right.
Check the ferry schedule.
Okay.
There's going to be some PDFs that you have to zoom in on to find these really Byzantine bus and ferry schedules. If you're going to see the pumpkin, you know, there's no entry fee or ticket or anything, but there will be a selfie line. So you're going to have to get in it.
Yeah.
And if you look outside the cities, there are these smaller inconvenient art places. We just published a story in the Japan Times by Mio Yamada about the Simose Art Museum in Otake, which is a ways out of Hiroshima City. There's Enoura Observatory. That's in Odawara. It's this amazing, amazing space by Hiroshi Sugimoto. And then in Hakone, there's also two great art spots. There's the Open Air Museum and the Polo Museum of Art. These are all just inconvenient enough that you could spend like one day from a major city and not have to do a whole ferry.
But, you know, for people who are coming here, is Naoshima kind of like the king?
I mean, I think it can be really rewarding. But actually, for me, the standout is still Teshima. And I don't want to give spoilers, but that's part of why it's so good is because there's almost no footage about like what's in there online.
Right.
You really just have to go and see it. And it's like there's no public transport. You have to go from Naoshima maybe and get like another ferry and then get an electric bike and then bike to the other side of the island. And
right. It's like super inconvenient art.
Super inconvenient. I've been there twice. I missed a boat because I was like so excited about it. And I was like in there crying. And I mean, I don't want to make it sound like super like culty or anything. But I think that once you see it, like you'll understand why it's so special.
All right, then I guess I got to move that one up to the top of my to-do list. Tu, thanks very much for coming on Deep Dive.
Thanks for having me.
My thanks again to Tu. We'll post a link to her story about inconvenient art in the show notes. And it was announced this week that a new museum will open on Naoshima in spring of next year. It will focus on contemporary works by Japanese and other Asian artists, and it is also being designed by Tarao Ando. And in other news, Japan's birth rate hit a new low last year of 1.2 kids per family. Replacement level fertility for developed countries needs to be 2.1 children per family in order to maintain the population. The new rate is the lowest since the government began keeping records in 1947, and the recent data also shows that Japanese women are having children later in life, so the average age for having a first child being 31. For comparison, that number was 25.7 in 1975. Chief Cabinet Secretary Yoshimasa Hayashi said during a news conference that the next 6 years, before we hit 2030, will be critical in trying to halt the depopulation trend. Tokyo is trying to do its part in reversing the trend by announcing a new dating app. Users will be required to submit documentation that they are legally single, sign a letter stating they're willing to get married, and verify their annual salary through a tax certificate. So happy swiping. For more on those stories, check the Japan Times online at japantimes.co.jp. Deep Dive is produced by Dave Cortez. Our outgoing music is by Oscar Boyd, and our theme music is by the Japanese musician 4L. I'm Sean McKenna. お疲れ様